League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
From the pages of The Blizzard, the Football Quarterly, we bring you The Blizzard Podcast, a weekly look back through the Blizzard archives, where we bring you some of our favourite articles to have appeared in the magazine since we began back in 2011. In episode 39, rather than an article, we bring you the audio from our Q&A event at the WS Society in Edinburgh on the 19th of May. The panel of Jonathan Wilson, Philippe Auclair, Alan Patillo and Kevin McCarra answered audience and Twitter questions on a range of subjects including unintelligent footballers, the upcoming European Championships, safe standing and other Scottish football chat, the best goals they'd ever seen in the stadium, and the Chablis in the Auxerre press room. Before we bring you the evening's proceedings, just a quick reminder that issue 21 of The Blizzard is now available to pre-order and will be released to subscribers on the 7th of June. Issue 21 is something of a Euro special and features, among others, Scott Murray on a selection of the key games from perhaps the greatest ever international tournament, Euro 76, Rob Smythe's greatest games feature on Denmark 3, Belgium 2 from the group stages at Euro 84, Philippe Auclair on the unconventional striker André-Pierre Gignac, James Montague on the drone controversy from Albania versus Serbia, as well as features on some of the coaches at this summer's tournament, including Michael O'Neill, Jan Kozak and Leonid Slutsky. You can pre-order issue 21 from theblizzard.co.uk now, and it will be released on downloads on a pay-what-you-like basis on the 10th of June to coincide with the start of the tournament. But for now, on to part one of our Q&A from Edinburgh. As with all our live events, we do the best we can with the available sound quality. Unfortunately, recording in large cavernous rooms means that you don't get studio-quality sound, but hopefully that doesn't detract from your enjoyment of the evening. The first voice you'll hear is that of our host for the evening, Daniel Gray.
Well, I am probably a lot more like you people in the audience down there, you people, in that I'm a fan. I've rarely met a footballer in my life. I write about football culture. I know more about burger kiosks than the Champions League. So I'm always fascinated to be around real football writers, real journalists who get to meet footballers. So I'm wondering for each of the panel, starting to my right, who is the least intelligent footballer you've ever met?
We've actually prepared this question before, and we were hesitating amongst several players of the same team and wondering if their intellectual lack of prowess meant that was the main reason why they were relegated from the Premier League this season. That is the English Premier League, and they finished last, so I don't need to tell you which club it is. But I think, you know, there are several kinds of... If you talk about intelligence or lack of, there's sometimes naivety. I was talking to the boys about a chap from Arsenal who, when he arrived at the club, was given a mobile phone. And he thought that to use this mobile phone, he had to go in a phone booth. It wouldn't work anywhere else. So, but that's naivety. But then there is another kind of stupidity, which is people who are absolutely convinced they're right all the time, even though they're wrong, and who are crap at their job. And... Gareth, this is not on the record. Thank you. I have to say the one who's impressed me the most in this is a mixture of... It's probably very tough on him, and good luck to Wales. Good luck to Wales. That's on the record. Thank you.
Kevin.
Oh, he's intelligent. That's me. I don't know. I mean, I think football players sometimes like to be monosyllabic and come across them in that way they can curtail the interview, and I think two clubs always have something hovering over them and stopping them from saying anything interesting, you know, at all costs. But just say that there are exceptions. I think a guy who lives close to my house, Neil Lennon in Glasgow, has a beautiful house and is a charming man. Nobody believes it. I think because he tackled people in midfield and knew what was coming next and stopped the wave of attacks from the other team. And for some reason, that was considered an appalling, you know, thing to do, and he was a horrible man. he's actually a charming person who goes has a normal life, and as I say, goes to the pub and things like that. And yet, I've never understood it. Is it because he was so clever at stopping the opposition, he just annoyed them, you know, and that became a flaw in his character rather than being a really good element of intelligence to cope with those games. And so I'm glad now that he's having a really peaceful life, and no one recently has tried to kill him, as far as I know. But I'll be back later on tonight, I'll let you know.
Alan, feel free to break the mold and talk about intelligent players too, if you like.
Yeah. Well, I was just saying earlier, having spent about 7 years of my life writing a book about Duncan Ferguson, I feel like my default answer to every question I'm asked about football is Duncan Ferguson. But it's probably possibly Duncan Ferguson. I happen to think he's a very, for me, I like to think he's quite an enigmatic character. But yeah, I suppose the view of most people is that he wasn't blessed in the brains department. I remember Craig Brown giving me a great story when I was researching the book about a trip, one of Duncan's few Scotland appearances, one of his seven Scotland appearances was in Athens, I think, in a qualifier against Greece, and they were organising a squad outing in the afternoon, I think, prior to the game, and Craig said to Duncan, we're going to the Acropolis for an afternoon. We're going to get ready for that. We're going to be leaving in an hour or so. And Duncan apparently replied, "Bloody hell, Acropolis! What a place! The nightclubs are open in the afternoon here." So possibly that. Yeah, I'd possibly have to probably say Duncan Ferguson. But seeing as we're in the capital in Edinburgh here, I guess another player that comes to mind readily is dear old Gary O'Connor, who now managing, you know, very impressively. I like the thought of him sort of starting down at the lower reaches at Selkirk managing. But I think I've done a few interviews with him over the years, and I think he possibly, you know, love him dearly, you know, a lovely guy, but yeah, doesn't think too much, you know, which possibly helps him on the football pitch, doesn't think too much. I remember Andy Roxburgh telling me that the best managers are those. He was explaining why the best players don't often become best managers, and he said because the best players are usually instinctive on the pitch, and when it comes to thinking too much about things, you know, they can't be doing with that. So, yeah, I think Gary O'Connor is possibly a good example of that, I think.
I had the privilege of being at Selkirk Town in Gary O'Connor's dressing room recently while I wasn't there, looking at his tactics board, which does exist.
Wow. And
rumours that there were 12 men on there are yet to be confirmed.
That was Stuart Pearce.
We've all done it. Jonathan.
Well, it's strange this question was posed. I arrived very late because I was coming back from Basel last night. So this is all planned without me. So it's their fault if it goes wrong. But weirdly, we were talking about this at about 3:30 this morning in a bar in Basel, largely because Micah Richards has emerged as a candidate for the thickest Premier League footballer ever. And I unfortunately can't remember what the details of the story, but for me the benchmark is a former Villa player. And Kevin, you might remember this because we went to Sardinia just before year 2004. All the pack who followed England national team went to the pre-tournament training camp in Sardinia, and the journalists were paired up, and you got the players were split in two, and you. Each pair of journalists got a player, and then they got another player. So each did two interviews. You shared all the quotes, and I was very, very junior, so I was pretty low down the pecking order for who I got. So in the second round, I got Phil Neville, which is fine because Phil Neville will talk all day. He's very interesting, very bright guy, very articulate guy. The first round, I got Darius Vassell, and there was a real reason why they gave him to the new kid. I think in 20 minutes he might have said 20 words. But the story about him that sort of confirms that it's not just he's inarticulate, he's actually fundamentally stupid, is that he had a swollen toe. And so he did what, the natural thing. He went to his garage and got a small drill. Oh. And drilled through the toenail to release the pressure. It didn't work. But then it also occurred to me, just to talk about, there's a lot of stories about footballers that are apocryphal. So one of the famous ones is about Ian Rush saying that playing in Italy was like playing in a foreign country, which the poor bloke never said. It was Kenny Dalglish made it up to take the mickey out of him. And then the other story about Ian Rush, which I don't know if it was a Dalglish invention, I cannot believe this is true, is that there was some sort of revered old journalist from North Wales who Rush had known when he was growing up, who died. And so supposedly a journalist rings Ian Rush for a quote for the obit. And Rush says, "Oh God, he's dead. What did he die of?" And the journalist says to him, "Yeah, you know, it was the big C." And Rush goes, "What? He drowned." But as I say, I don't think that is true.
Right, well, wanted to begin my first question talking about fans and supporter culture and with reference to Celtic Park, really, because the first of the safe standing area has begun, as you'll know, in the last couple of weeks, the construction of, I should say. Kevin, on the Celtic front, do you think it'll work well? Are you in favour of reintroducing standing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the idea that standing up was a cause of disaster is crazy. I mean, it never was. Enforcing people to sit and as they did, and still does have in most crowds, Hampton, for example, is all seated and so on. And I think when you're forced to stay exactly where you are and not move along or whatever, you feel as if you've just been an automaton or something. You're not a person, you know, you can't wander about the ground all that easily. And I think for that reason, the barrier of seats, I mean, obviously we need seats, but it should be, there must be areas too where people can surely stand and watch a game and enjoy it without thinking they're about to be killed at any moment. I mean, I think it's the design of these grounds now doesn't really have that possibility of that kind of disaster again.
Alan, will it work at Celtic?
I think it will. Yeah, definitely. I'm intrigued to find out how it goes next season, but I think it will work. And why shouldn't it really? And as Kevin was saying, you go to a game now. You go to a big game now. I was at one. And for my sins, I'm a Dundee fan, so I was at Ibrox a few weeks ago for a Scottish Cup game, and 40,000 people there, and we're all standing. Everyone was standing, you know. You know, legs getting almost sort of cut off at the knee there when you're sort of surging forward a bit. So yeah, I mean, I think to have a all standing area, which sort of complies with the safety restrictions, etc. I think it's for safety purposes alone, it should be coming in, because it's dangerous right now. People standing in seats, because if there's a surge, if there's a goal, you end up toppling over the seat in front of you, and that is dangerous. So yeah, I'm fully in favour of it, and hats off to Celtic for pushing it through.
I don't think it's been a good season unless you've got those bruise marks on those parts of you for the whole of the summer. Jonathan, do you think it could work in the Premier League? I mean, a lot of the football I go to up here is standing anyway. It's Cowden Beath, it's Ayr and places like that still have beautiful terraces. Do you think it could work in this higher echelon as the Premier League, given how big crowds are?
Well, it works in the Bundesliga, so why not? You know, Bundesliga has the biggest crowds in the world, so why not anywhere? I completely understand why people are cautious about the reintroduction, but I mean, the Bundesliga proves that you can do it. And I think, I mean, it's almost a trivial point, but I think something has been lost from atmospheres because you can't move about, because you can't. If you and your mates buy tickets separately, you can't guarantee being together. And if you are standing, you can gravitate to your mates or people who enjoy the game in the way that you want to enjoy it. So you'd still have the seated sections for people who prefer to be a bit more sedate. But if you want to sing and shout, then you can find other people who want to sing and shout. So I think it would improve atmospheres, which in the Premier League certainly have become tamer, quieter in the way. And standing's not the only reason for that, but it's a reason. So yeah, I completely understand the caution, but I think the Bundesliga example proves that it can be done safely.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, Kevin.
I just one quick thing. I did find how interesting it was to see people way back in the 70s standing on empty cans of lager, many of which they'd taken into the ground because there was no stopping it. You know, that was just part of the game. You know, and you think nowadays, how did they get through that at Hampden without a disaster of that type. So, I mean, although the atmosphere has gone a bit, I think it's a decent payoff in the...
Absolutely, but I mean, if you can have both, which a Bundesliga seems to manage...
Well, yeah, I mean, that's only just beginning to come in, though, isn't it? You know,
One of the problems that the Premier League, especially the English Premier League clubs will have, when I say problems, one of the reasons why they might be very reticent is that because of the amount of money they charge for the tickets, which come with a very comfortable seat in those new stadiums, you certainly can't ask people to cough up, you know, 60 quid for standing, you know, in not very comfortable situations. And I think they're thinking of that. Because you could think, okay, it's going to be compensated by the greater number of people who can be accommodated, but it's what, 1.8 for one, the ratio, which is deemed safe, but it's the limit, isn't it? So ideally, you'd like to have one for one. So there might be a cost problem there, or rather a profit problem.
Okay, well, we're going to come to the audience shortly, so get your questions and abuse fired up. But first, we've got some Twitter questions from Gareth, who hasn't got a microphone. I'll have to shout.
This first one is from Cowden Harley on Twitter, saying, what's the panel's take on media saturation of football skewing what people expect of their team? So if you see Barcelona and Real Madrid on telly every week, you see that as the norm and then expect Cowdenbeath to do the same.
It's a very good question. I think Cowdenbeath frequently do the same, but I have a strange soft spot for Cowdenbeath. Let's not go there. Jonathan?
I'm not sure it's because people are watching Barcelona and Real Madrid every week that they sort of expect that kind of football from their team. I think people sort of accept that Barcelona and Real Madrid are on a different level. But I think what certainly is true is that the mass focus on football, the need for stories, the need for narrative, has decreased the patience of fans. That, you know, if you've seen it with Pep Guardiola, you know, he's been in six Champions League semi-finals. He's never not got to the semi-final of the Champions League. That's an extraordinary record. No other manager in history has a record remotely resembling that. That's partly to do with the economics of modern football. But even then, there's other managers now who are nowhere near that. And yet, he's being described as a failure and a fraud because Bayern haven't won the Champions League under him. So, and that's an extreme example, but you see that replicated pretty much every club that, you know, the expectation that you should have perpetual success has you know, decreased the lifespan of managers. And I think Alex Ferguson made the point that reality TV has now created this culture where people expect to be able to vote people out. And so every week you have which club's in crisis this week, you know, which club's drawn a game they should have won, and then the pressure's on that manager. And you look at that manager over a period of sort of 3 or 4 years, and their record might be very, very good. So Kike Sanchez-Flores at Watford this season, who at Christmas everybody was saying he's doing a brilliant job, and suddenly he's out of the job. Whereas if you'd offered this season to Watford, you know, this time last year, they'd have been delighted.
I mean, the one thing perhaps as well is that it means that the profile of the fan has changed. The audience has increased tremendously, but the attendances at the grounds haven't increased that much. Okay, it's packed in the top division, in some clubs, as well in level 2 or 3. But then suddenly you've got people who have got what they think is knowledge, understanding of football, and who don't go to football games. And therefore who sometimes have some strange opinions, to say the least. I mean, when you spend a bit of your life on Twitter, as we all do, heavens above what we get. And it's clearly, yes, I think there is an idea that every club should be able to play at this kind of level, otherwise they're crap. But anyway, it's not shades of grey. It's either crap or very, very good indeed. And but on the other hand, we're not going to complain too much because we've got more work, huh? Should we?
As we're on the heavens above Twitter, Gareth, any more Twitter questions?
One from Ian Gorman. For the whole panel, what's the best goal that they've ever seen live at a game they've been covering?
Alan, if it's not Dundee, I'll...
No, I won't go to Dundee for this one. Best goal I've seen live, definitely, I think, the Zidane's winner for Real in the European Cup final at Hampden. I can barely, even now, my view of it is the view I saw of it live from Hampden, from the press box of Hampden. Just a wonderful left foot volley into the top corner. For some strange reason, I don't think I've seen it again on television for some bizarre reason. I just have not seen it. So in my mind's eye, it's watching it live, and I think that increases the magic of it and just the artistry of it. So yeah, I don't want to see it again. I don't want to see it on TV, so I'm going to have to try and avoid it for the rest of my life somehow. But
Kevin?
I was going to say Archer Gemmell's goal against Holland. That was I'm a Scottish fan, but I think that was quite incredible bit of skill to open up the game as he did in that game. The sad thing is, I mean, Scotland are good players now, but I don't see anyone as influential or as imaginative as that. You know, they're good players, but solid. But I guess you'd have to wait and see what happens as the years go by. Does somebody suddenly appear and ignite the whole thing again? Scotland are quite a decent team, but when you get Lewandowski, for example, doing something that's fantastic shot and that finished Gordon Strachan's hopes of getting to Euro 2016. One brilliant shot, and that changed the whole thing. Jonathan?
I think there is, you're absolutely right about the difference of being in the stadium, and there's something about just the angle you might happen to be at. So at the World Cup in 2014, I was at the Colombia-Uruguay game, and I was right in line with James Rodriguez when the ball dropped to him. And you sort of thought, oh, if he just chests that up, he can volley that. And then, of course, sure enough, he does chest up and volleys it. And I was right behind the line of that shot. And you could see it was going, you know, a foot under the bar, a foot inside the post. So much as I'd like to say Colin Pascoe's leaping header for Sunderland against Chelsea in 1991, I think realistically probably that James Rodriguez goal at the World Cup.
The best I've seen in terms of technical terms, without a doubt, is Dennis Bergkamp for Arsenal against Newcastle. That was absolutely extraordinary. And the reason why I think it's the best is still I still don't understand how you can do it. I've watched it about... That's the difference. Mm. I've watched it about 1,000 times. I still don't know how he does it and how he thinks about it. But the one which moved me the most, and which in many ways makes it the most beautiful goal for me that I've seen live, was Clint Dempsey's goal for Fulham against Juve at Craven Cottage, because of the emotional quality of the night. And when, to be honest, in the press box, we were not journalists anymore. We were all fans of Fulham, I have to say, because of the show they put on, and because this grand old beautiful stadium was shaking like nothing. And out of nowhere, being from 1-0 down and condemned, this team qualified against mighty Juve, Fulham, you know. And with this gorgeous chip by Clint Dempsey, so that's definitely the one for me.
Okay, audience questions then.
If there are any.
Any, no. Surely something. Fella there is taking Tony Adams-style offside appeal.
Oh yes, of course, Tony Adams against Everton, 4-0.
Got a question for three members of the panel. It'll be obvious which three. I followed Newcastle for 40 years. 30 years of those in Scotland. In that time, we've not won a trophy and we've been relegated most decades. Yet I still think Newcastle are a big club. Am I deluding myself?
Anyone?
Well, Jonathan should
Jonathan's not allowed. Middlesbrough and Sunderland aren't allowed.
Of course he's allowed. They've won fewer trophies than Sunderland.
They have won fewer league championships than Sunderland, which is the real test of the side. And next season, I don't want to rub this in, but God, I'm going to take the opportunity while I can. Next season will be the first time since 1993 that Newcastle have been the third of the three northeastern sides. It'll be the first time since 1982, I think, that they've not been top flight, and Middlesbrough and Sunderland both have been. And of course, Newcastle are a big side. I mean, they get 50,000 fans every week. I mean, despite Mike Ashley's attempts to his very successful attempts to suck the life out of the club, yeah, of course, they're a big team. As Sunderland are a big team. Sunderland are a better team as well. Nicer people, nicer place, greater history. But if you're, there's clear parallels between Sunderland and Newcastle. They both get, 45,000 plus on a regular basis. And if that's not enough in the Premier League to make you a big team, then what is? I mean, both clubs have been horrendously mismanaged from a boardroom level in, I think, quite different ways in recent years. That I think while Ella Short's made many mistakes, I think he essentially wants to do things that are good, whereas Mike Ashley, I don't really understand what he wants to do other than make a profit. But yeah, I mean, I think the lack of trophies is a slightly freakish thing. I mean, surely sometime. I have to say, when Middlesbrough won the League Cup in 2006, with a penalty that was kicked twice, so it shouldn't have counted, that was a dagger to the heart, because that was, you could always look at Middlesbrough and go, well, yeah, you've never won anything. And now they're the Northeastern team who've most recently won something, and that's quite painful for somebody who essentially you consider as being sort of like a stone in your shoe, you know, irritating, but not really important.
I'm the host, so I can't comment. Alan? I'm going to ask you about Newcastle. And I find,
it's interesting,
especially living in Edinburgh, when I go down to Middlesbrough, there's loads of Scottish support, whether it's exiled Geordies or not, I don't know.
It's interesting what the mark of a big club is. I mean, obviously, I guess trophies, but we might come back to this later on in terms of trophy famines, etc. I mean, how long is it since Newcastle won a major trophy then?
They won the first cup in 69.
Good grief. I mean, is that a mark? I guess it is. I mean, what I find is quite extraordinary in Scottish football, you're thinking Ross County and Inverness have won a major trophy more recently than Aberdeen. Is that a mark of them being bigger clubs than Aberdeen? Perhaps. I guess an Aberdeen fan wouldn't agree with that. But, I don't know. Who's a bigger club from Newcastle and Sunderland and Middlesbrough? I'd say Newcastle, but I'm probably coming at it from a...
you can have clubs that have won nothing for quite a while and which are still considered great clubs in their own countries. I mean, Red Star in Paris is most definitely one of the clubs that should be the best known and historically one of the most important in French football history. They haven't won a trophy since 1942. That's a long, long time ago. And they are now, they've been relegated, God knows how many times, and they are now in the second tier of the French League, and there's genuine excitement about it, because it could be, it would be the same thing if Notts County, who haven't won anything for even longer than that, came back up. They are still, you can be a crap team and a great club at the same time, and Newcastle are certainly both.
Okay, another audience question at the front here.
A question for the biographers on the panel. What was the hardest part of doing the biography? What's a good story that never made it in? And what was the reaction from the subject of your books?
For me?
Yeah, to all, the biographers on the panel.
You've all done biographies in their own way, haven't you? So
yeah.
I mean, I was very fortunate that Clough was dead by the time I did mine. I was quite safe. I don't know what the family thought. I wrote to Nigel before I wrote the book, and he said he didn't want to be involved, which is fair enough. And I've tried to leave family stuff out because I think people have a right to privacy. My situation is very different, obviously, to doing people who are still alive.
My subject was very much still alive. Duncan Ferguson, I did write to him. I wrote to him. I wrote to his parents as well, because when I started writing the book, Duncan had disappeared off the earth.
Can
as
read.
Far as I was concerned.
He can read.
He can't. Well, I don't know. I never got a reply to the letter I sent, but he had disappeared, and I thought, and I was just fascinated by the story of a guy who was one of the big name Scottish footballers of the time. I just turned his back on the game and in a very enigmatic way, scored a goal with his last touch in professional football, a penalty that was scuffed. He scuffed, and the ball came back, rebound against West Bromwich Albion, and he just managed to get in the rebound, which I thought just kind of summed up his career almost. And then he disappeared. So I thought I resolved to write a book about this chap. But yeah, obviously I knew his reputation with press wasn't great. It's a great story about the time he was interviewed by, I think, Goal magazine, and for once Duncan had managed. He'd agreed to sit down with a journalist to do an interview, but it was to market his new mitre boots. So the journalist from Goal magazine went and to do an interview. Normally in these situations, you get the boots questions out of the way, you get that done, then you go on and have a more rounded conversation, but Duncan was absolutely adamant that, no, it was just going to talk about mitre boots, and that was it. And so the journalist, Bill Burrows, did a great piece, sort of just taking the piss out of Duncan, really, in the end, just basically saying, just verbatim, how these questions would go. He'd ask a question, Duncan, I'm here to talk about mitre boots, that's it, I'm not going there, you know. And he just did this wonderful piece, which the magazine ran the next month, and then, apparently, Bailey, Magazine Bailey reached the newsstands, and Mitre PR girl was on the phone saying, you know, what the hell have you done to Duncan Ferguson? So, yeah, so possibly that's another reason why Duncan didn't speak to journalists, but he certainly didn't speak to me. I wrote to him, pointed out what I was hoping to do. I told him it would be a sympathetic book, but he didn't get back to me. I went to his parents' house, knocked on the door in Stirling, and just to sort of try and outline what I was doing, but no answer. And I still remember being, my knees were almost knocking at the doorstep, and no answer. So anyway, I wandered away, got into my car, went down the road, went round the roundabout, end of the road, came back up, and there was this sort of figure peering out the window, clearly thinking, who the hell was this at my front door? And I don't know whether it was Duncan or whether it was Duncan Ferguson Sr., his father, who apparently is even more fearsome than Duncan's. I didn't particularly want to meet him either, but yeah, so...
It's like the Biffa Bacon family.
Yes, well, it kind of is, actually, yeah. Even Jim McLean, apparently, was the fearsome manager of Dundee United, was petrified of Duncan's father. In the end, I didn't, to answer your question, I didn't get an answer from Duncan. I wrote the book and it came out, and you know, I'm still here to tell the tale, I think. So, you know, he hasn't sued me yet either, so I hope he's okay with that. I sent him a copy, and you know, I'd like to think I presented both sides of the Duncan Ferguson argument, really.
Kevin, on biography, when do you choose to leave things out?
I mean, football is not all that volatile. We make it up as it is. I go the way off. I just find them as being fairly ordinary people like me or you or so on. But they're under extreme pressures. And, you know, maybe worrying about losing a place in team. And that can happen from one week to another. Your form goes and you're in the wilderness. So I think football players have to have a tough hide. It's a great career, and the money is vast, but I think players always feel vulnerable. A new manager comes, he drops you, or you get an injury and you think, he's getting on a bit, I'll leave him on the bench and so on. I think anxiety is far more associated with football players than with joy and happiness. I think they worry a lot.
As we're approaching half-time, I'm going to come to a question at the back of the room there. Someone was waving madly there, I think. I'm listening to the answers.
But by the way, I just wanted to say one thing about biographies. You say, where do you stop? It's something called a legal read.
Depends on the publisher. Okay, the question there. Apologies.
Depends on the lawyer.
Yeah. Can anyone hear me? Yeah. My question is, which club would you say has been most mistreated by modern football? And why is it Coventry City?
Philippe,
as you didn't get to answer.
No. I cannot answer this question. Maybe you should answer it yourself. I just don't understand what's going on in that club. And you talk about, again, a great club and actually not a crap team. I, to be honest, I don't think I'm in a position of authority enough to make many comments about Coventry, because my last memory of Coventry is 1987 FA Cup final. So I'm genuinely not qualified to talk about the Sky Blues, I'm afraid.
So it's the way the modern game's been cruel to a club. Do any examples come to you?
Well, I mean, with respect to Coventry, obviously they've suffered terribly recently. Maybe I'd have more sympathy if they hadn't cheated someone to relegation in 1977.
That's the Jimmy Hill story, right?
The Jimmy Hill story, yeah. Okay. There was, this is, five, 6 years ago, Fulham unveiled a statue to Johnny Haynes, and they got loads of Fulham greats back, and it happened to be a Fulham versus Sunderland. So a game you'd think should not be in any way sort of volatile. And then as these Fulham legends parade out, and you know, you've got Alan Mullery and people, and Sunderland fans are politely applauding them. And then Jimmy Hill comes out, and there's just this deluge of abuse. There's loads of clips on YouTube of it. It is some of the loudest, foulest abuse you'll ever hear. It was magnificent. And the reason for this is in 1977, Sunderland had gone up in 76 with the remnants of a team that won the Cup in 73. But Bob Stokoe had fallen ill. And he ended up, I think Sunderland only won two games when he retired because of ill health. I think the beginning of December, maybe the end of November, but about a month before Christmas. And Sunderland are in a terrible position. There's no way they're going to avoid relegation. Jimmy Adamson comes in, decides to promote loads of kids, essentially to get ready for the next season, assuming they're going to go down. And among those kids who come through were Kevin Arnott, who was a very gifted, very cultured midfielder. Gary Rowell, who I think is the fourth or maybe fifth highest Sunderland goal scorer of all time, and was sort of a great goal scoring legend of my youth. And Sean Elliott, who was sort of the ball playing centre back, could play at the back of midfield. His career was was crocked by Graeme Souness, never came back properly after an injury. I'm sure it was a fair challenge. I've drifted completely off point. Anyway, so we have this beautiful young team that starts playing fantastic football. And there was four successive home games when Sunderland scored at least four goals. And they're climbing away from the bottom. Gets to the final day of the season. And Sunderland went to Everton. And if they got a point, they'd have stayed up. Bristol City and Coventry were also in danger of going down. And if it was a winner in that game, the loser went down, irrespective of what Sunderland did at Everton. If that game was a draw and Sunderland lost, then Sunderland went down. But that was the only circumstance in which Sunderland could go down. Because Sunderland being Sunderland, bit of pressure, they lose 2-0 to Everton. And Coventry versus Bristol City mysteriously starts late because of crowd congestion, which in literally no other game in the 70s in England started late because of crowd congestion. Nobody had even invented the term crowd congestion till Jimmy Hill has this idea, Jimmy Hill being the Coventry chairman at the time. So the game starts late, so they know the final sort of 15, 20 minutes that they just need a draw. And guess what? They play out a 2-2 draw. The Sunderland scores on the scoreboard. The players literally sitting on the ground, kicking the ball to each other. It's one of the, it's an abomination. It defiled football. It defiled fair play. This beautiful young team destroyed by this evil cynic. And the Football League investigated, and they sanctioned Coventry and Jimmy Hill, but no penalty. So if karma has come back to bite Coventry, well, that's unfortunate.
Right. Well, on that private hell, we better go to half time, and feel free to boo us off. But see you in 15 minutes or so.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.